This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good evening. It is Wednesday, January 2nd, 2013. New year, or I guess the first year for the new year. So thank you for coming out. And this is going to be a fun one. Wasn't initially on the schedule, but after the events at Sandy Hook, a lot of people have been talking about gun control, in particular from Jewish perspectives on what gun control ought to be or ought to look like. So I figured, since the whole point of this class is to discuss halachot that are particularly relevant, if something comes up that doesn't interrupt our schedule, we should try to deal with it. And for something like gun control, it begs the obvious question of, though we discussed for certain things like brain death, which is, how do you have a Jewish perspective on something that didn't really exist? Mm-hmm. Right? Guns didn't exist in the times of the Gemara, right? So how could we have any position on it? So the answer to that is, with many things that seem new, is you try to find what are the most pertinent analogs that you have in Jewish law. So you say, well, guns might not have existed, but guns are most like X, or what we're discussing is most like Y. And that leads to some very interesting discussions, and people have been throwing out a lot of different ideas in terms of, how should we approach this from a Jewish law, looking at a myriad of different sources and somehow spinning them one way or another to try to conclude this is the Jewish opinion. What this means is that I don't think there is a Jewish opinion as much as you have a lot of people saying, people are going to write persuasively, they'll write from a perspective of Jewish perspective must mean X. We must demand, gun reform, which I don't think is accurate. I think it may be a plausible read, but I don't think it's the only plausible read. And people, even if they're citing sources correctly, they're also going to be cherry-picking ones that most match their, ideology of how things are. Mm-hmm. And in complete honesty, I did too. Meaning, I quote some sources here that a lot of other people do because they're very obvious analogs, and a few others that, might not have come up to other people, but to me, really speak to a lot of the issues that are being discussed in the gun debate today. Now, you can say, oh, but I didn't quote something? Yeah, that's probably true, either because I wasn't aware of it, or I am aware of it, and I don't think it's relevant, or at least not as relevant as the things that I am citing now. Mm-hmm. All right? So I'll start with just the first one as a matter of context. And that is, between American law and Jewish law, when you get to the American law, you've got the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which states a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Okay? Now, there's, as you can imagine, a great deal of debate off of this, where, is it based off of the militia part, meaning is it the right of the people specifically to the militia, or is the right of the people something more general? The reason why I'm mentioning this here at the outset is simply to distinguish between the American law and any discussion about American policy and Jewish law. I've said, on a few different occasions that the Torah is like the constitution of the Jewish people that's then interpreted by the Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin. But the reverse you could say is also true, that if the Torah is the constitution of the Jewish people, if the Torah is the constitution of the Jewish people, the constitution is the Torah of the American people. Mm-hmm. And there was actually an op-ed in the Times this past week where someone was pretty much arguing for scrapping the constitution, which were mostly the parts that he didn't like. Meaning, mm-hmm. It's like, freedom of speech here, we can keep that. Like, but there's a reason why you have a constitution. It provides an objective law that keeps us together. If you want to amend the constitution, there are, ways of doing that, just a lot harder. Mm-hmm. But the constitution is going to function as the Torah, which means when you're talking about the civil, the debates for civil laws and civil policy, you're not just talking about what you think is morally correct or what you think, may make the most sense. You're dealing with a constitution. constitutional right, which means it has to be in the context of constitutional law. Now, yes, do we have constitutional rights that seem to be restricted or regulated? Well, sure. I mean, we have a lot of gun regulations on the books that have passed constitutional muster. Mm-hmm. You could say for certain things like, you know, right to privacy and by extension abortion have been regulated too. But it means you have to have very, you know, careful discussions over what does it mean to have a constitutional right and which ones, you know, can you legislate more than others? Because once you start saying, well, if our society says we can, you know, start legislating this, we can start legislating that. And if someone rhetorically says, well, you can't legislate against that, we have an inherent right. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you want to say every right is an absolute right, you could read the Second Amendment that says every U.S. citizen has a legitimate right to hold any, you know, weapon or ordnance that they wish, mm-hmm. which we don't.
Right.
And you may argue that we're probably better off for that. The point is, that is, while those are interesting discussions or important discussions, they're completely irrelevant for this discussion. Because we're not talking about what ought to be good policy for the United States. Mm-hmm. That's left up not just to, you know, various policymakers who study these things, but constitutional scholars who know how to, or I shouldn't say know how, but who'll have in the back of their head, you know, how do you go about crafting legislation that will actually be upheld by the courts. I have no idea what mm-hmm. they're doing upstairs. We have a theater group, and apparently they're moving stuff. The less I know, the better. Okay, so just wanted to get that very important distinction between Jewish law and civil law. In particular, whatever we come up with today has no bearing on American policy because those are constitutional issues. Talk to a constitutional lawyer, and I'm sure you'll have a great deal of fun with that. So, Jewish law. So the first thing that gets quoted is a Mishnah and a Gemara from Shabbat that we did in Daf Yomi not too long ago that gives us a general view on weapons. And I wanted to start here because when you think about what guns are, you know, when we try to make these, you know, analogies between what exists in the times of the Talmud, a gun is a tool, all right, that is one purpose, which is, you know, to kill, or if your aim might not be that great, to injure or maim. Mm-hmm. Right? You can kill with a lot of other tools as well. You can kill with a giant rock, right? You can kill with, there are lots of ways to commit murder, but there seem to be like no other purpose aside for a gun aside from killing. Mm-hmm. But even when you say killing, there are different types of killing, right? You've got murder, which we normally say is bad. Mass murder, which you would say would be worse because it's murder, just a whole lot more of it. But you could also say things like, well, maybe there's self-defense. That could work. Or even forgetting about self-defense, people hunt for food, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not going to get into what guns are, you know, useful for which, but it means that even though that a gun's major purpose is to kill, right? Or, you know, maybe if you want to say to kill, maybe it's to build a skill of learning how to shoot better. Mm-hmm. Meaning you can view it as like, let's do it as a parallel, archery. Right? Bow and arrow. Those existed back in the time of the Gemara. Mm-hmm. You could use a bow and arrow to kill someone. You could use a bow and arrow to hunt for food. You could also use a bow and arrow for sport. Mm-hmm. Today, shooting is in the Olympics in a couple of different categories, mm-hmm. Both summer and winter in the biathlon, which is skiing and shooting. How those two got together, I don't know. But it's considered a skill, just like archery is considered a skill. Mm-hmm. All right? So it's something to keep in mind, that at the end of the day, a gun is just a tool that happens to be used primarily for killing. All right? Any objections to that statement?
No,
okay.
Right.
Jamie, can you start us off with, this is a Mishnah in Shabbat 6:4. Talking about views of weapons here.
Man must not go out with a sword, bow, shield, lance, or spear. And if he does go out, he incurs a sin offering. Rabbi Eliezer said they are ornaments for him. But the sages maintain they are merely shameful. For it is said, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore.
Right, you may be familiar with that. Pasuk Lisa Goel Goy Karevali Mildoy Milchama. So here you have a debate between Rebbe Eliezer and the Chachamim. According to Rebbe Eliezer, these weapons are considered a tachshit, are considered adornments, are considered like jewelry. Right, and the example that I give for this is the Marines. Anyone remember the? Do you guys remember the old Marine commercials? When I was growing up, they had these commercials for the Marines of like hammering, hammering and forging the sword. That's part of their dress uniform. Right? Marines don't just go around wearing swords, but it's part of their dress uniform. Mm-hmm. It's considered, right. But according to the sages, they're considered shameful. Weapons are considered gnai. Now, you can argue, I mean, we can see, you know, which should be included here. Meaning, you know, a sayaf, a sword, is pretty much only used for killing. Right? That would be similar, you could say, to a gun. As opposed to, say, the bow, the keshet, which in theory could be used for both, but the truth is going out with it on Shabbat, you know, you wouldn't be allowed to use that either because, you know, you're not allowed to kill on Shabbat. Right. Right? But the lance and the spear are, I mean, well, I guess you could use a lance or a spear for hunting as well, but the pasuk at the end seems to speak specifically about the cherev, about the sword, mm-hmm. which you could say is your prototypical, it's of the things mentioned, are the only weapons used, you can say that's pretty much only for killing and killing other people. As opposed, no one goes hunting with a sword. There are other blades you might use for hunting. Right? So, continue, Jamie.
I guess when it's talking about going out, right? Because swords are sometimes used for, like, decoration. Like, you'll see it all the time, like, especially, like, you know, like the medieval things, right? The two swords and a shield or something like that.
No. This is like carrying with
right, this part is going of your dress on Shabbos. Right, okay. So
it's not just like having on, you know, your wall, like the coat of arms. Yeah. I haven't seen those in Lower East Side, though.
No, not so much.
Probably better off that way. So the Gemara in Shabbat 63a gives us a little more information here.
Okay. So Rabbi Eliezer said, "There are ornaments for him. It was taught, said they, to Rabbi Eliezer, since they are ornaments for him, why should they cease in the days of the Messiah? Because they will not be required," he answered, "as it is said, nation shall not lift up sword against nation. Yet let them exist merely as ornaments," said Abaye. "It may be compared to a candle at noon. Unnecessary and not beautiful."
Right, so his answer is like, well, so what do you do with this Lo Yisa Goyel Goy Charev thing? Mm-hmm. Now he says, oh, the reason why they're, you know, ornaments is because, well, they're not going to be required. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong. Like, there's something about a beauty to it, he mm-hmm. says. Like, if you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, they actually have a whole section there, medieval, sure. you know, sort of. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. Now this disagrees with Samuel, the view that they will cease to be in the days of the Messiah. For Samuel said, "This world differs from the Messianic era only in respect to servitude of the exiled, for it is said, for the poor shall never cease out of the land. This implies that poverty will continue in the Messianic era. Hence, the prophet's tiding of a new state of affairs cannot refer to the Messianic era, which would be the same as the present, save in this manner. This supports Rab Chia ben Abba, the Brita, which states that weapons of war will cease to exist in the Messianic age, who said, all the prophets prophesied only for the Messianic age, but as for the world to come, the eye hath not seen, O Lord, beside thee, what he hath prepared for him that waiteth for him.
Mm-hmm. All right, so continue how this affects us.
Some there are who state, said they, to Rabbi Eliezer, since they are ornaments for him, why should they cease in the days of the Messiah? In the days of the Messiah, too, they shall not cease, he answered. This is Samuel's view, and it disagrees with Rabbi Chia ben Abba's. Abaye asked Rabbi Dimi, another state, read Rabbi Avia, and others again state. Rabbi Joseph asked Rabbi Dimi, and others state Rabbi Avia, whilst others state Abaye asked Rabbi Joseph, what is Rabbi Eliezer's reason for maintaining that they are ornaments for him? Because it is written, gird thy sword upon thy thigh, O mighty one, thy glory and thy majesty. Rab Kana objected to Mar, son of Rab Huna, but this refers to the words of the Torah, thy sword is metaphorical for learning, which is Israel's weapon. It is indicative of the peace-loving spirit of the rabbis and their exaltation of Torah, that they regarded it as an axiomatic that such a verse cannot be taken literally. A verse cannot depart from its plain meaning, he replied. Granted that it is metaphorical, yet the Torah would not have been likened to the sword unless the latter were ornamental. Rabbi Kahana said, by the time I was 18 years old, I had studied the whole Shas, yet I did not know that a verse cannot depart from its plain meaning until today. What does he inform us? That a man should study and subsequently understand.
All right, so the end gets to a bit of a digression here. But you've got, I mean, the opinion of the rabbis that weapons are considered a gnai, right, are considered shameful, seems to be taken as a given. Right? And it seems almost obvious. Of course, you know, weapons are considered shameful because there's something intrinsically wrong with weapons. Mm-hmm. Right. But it's important to realize that that's a dispute, right? That there could be, you know, two other matters to discuss regarding weapons. One approach is not like Shmuel, which is that, let's say, wars do in fact cease, well, then you could still appreciate a weapon not just as a weapon for murder, but as, you know, an act of beauty. There are some gun nuts out, well, I shouldn't say gun nuts, that's already loaded. You've got gun aficionados who will, I apologize if there are any gun aficionados listening. There are some gun aficionados who can actually appreciate, you know, the subtleties of, you know, the weapon and like the construction and the physics behind it. Now, I can't, but they can, right? The other approach is actually an opinion that you're still going to need weapons in the time of the Mashiach, which is a pretty big deal from a theological standpoint. The main thing, though, is that it still is a dispute. And there are two ways of looking at things. It's not just a matter of, you know, all weapons are always bad, but there's another way of looking at it. It's like, well, you know, maybe there's not something intrinsically, you know, problematic about it. All right. But that's just from a very general standpoint. Let's get into some of the practical uses of weapons. And this the next section I want to discuss predominantly things related to defense. All right. Josh, can you take the three sources first?
Sure.
Is the pasuk in Exodus 22, 1 through 2.
Okay. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. If the thief is found breaking in and he is struck so that he dies, there shall be no guilt for his bloodshed.
All right. This is the law that we're going to see. It's called Baba Machteret. If someone comes in through a cave, and read the Mishnah, and that's the Gemara. This is Mishnah Sanhedrin 8:6.
Okay. The thief who borrows his way...
Who borrows
his way and is judged on an account...
Borrows his way in...
I see. The thief who borrows his way in is judged on account of its probable outcome. If he broke through and broke a jug, should there be blood guiltiness for him, he must pay for the jug. But if there is no blood guiltiness for him, he is not liable.
All right, and the Gemara Sanhedrin 72a.
Okay, Rava said, what is the reason for the law of breaking in? Because it is certain that no man is inactive where his property is concerned. Therefore, this one, the thief, must have reasoned, if I go there, he, the owner, will oppose me and prevent me. But if he does, I will kill him. Hence the Torah decreed, if he come to slay thee, forestall by slaying him.
Yeah. So, what do you get from this?
That you're allowed to kill in defense.
Right.
Trying to steal your stuff.
So, matter what, sort of. I mean, it gets, well, you know, partial. This is, I mean, there are detailed laws here of, you know, if as long as you feel that you're at risk. This is the specific cases. Someone breaks into my house at night. I don't see who it is. I can't tell who it is. I can shoot first, ask questions later. Right. Mm-hmm. Once I know who it is, or at least the light is shown upon him, not in danger. We'll see this a little bit in the next Gemara. Then no, it doesn't work. But this Gemara provides us with a very interesting rationale for it. Here's the logic. The logic is, if I'm the thief, I'm assuming a priori that the owner of the house is going to shoot to kill to protect his property. Therefore, I'm going to get a gun as such that if I run into him, I'm going to kill him first. And because the thief has that assumption about you, the owner, that gives you, the owner, the right to shoot him.
Mm-hmm.
Does this ring a bell? This is what you call, like, anyone familiar with the idiom MAD, mutually assured destruction?
Yeah.
Right? I think you guys are too young to remember the Cold War. You know, yes. But this was kind of, oh, man, I'm old. Yeah, Russia, U.S., that whole, right? You're talking about stockpiling here. And you think, like, well, what if you just, like, break that initial assumption that the owner isn't going to shoot you? Does that mean that the thief now no longer is going to have that assumption?
Right.
Right? It's sort of like, it's the cycle, or not cycle, but a psychological cycle of violence, mm-hmm. where the thief is, because the thief assumes the owner has a gun, then that assumption of the thief is, in fact, what enables the owner to shoot to kill.
Right. Yeah.
Sounds a little weird. No, do you see the logic? It's a little weird.
Yeah.
But that's how the Gemara explains it. And take the next source, Sanhedrin 72b, that gives us a little more detail.
Okay. Our rabbis taught, if a thief be found breaking up and be smitten by any man that he die by any death wherewith you can slay him.
Meaning it doesn't matter how you kill him, right, when he's gone.
Right. Now, the exegesis, and be smitten by any man is rightly necessary, for I might think that only the owner may be assumed not to remain passive. Whilst his money is being stolen, but not a stranger, for it is only because of that assumption that his death is regarded as self-defense, but a stranger might not be assumed by the thief actively to interfere. Therefore, the thief is not likely to slay him, and hence his death at the hands of a stranger is not in self-defense. It is therefore taught that he is regarded as a potential murderer, whom even a stranger may kill in defense of the owner.
Right, so let's say I'm a guest in someone's house, I'm allowed to kill the guy, even though it's not my stuff. Right? Because once the thief has this assumption, he's considered a rodent that we're going to see next. But in the meantime, isn't it like, even though the whole premise is self-defense, no, doesn't matter. Once you're in that halacha of considered a rodent, I can kill you. Anyone can.
But what need of that he die? By any death wherewith you can slay him, can this not be deduced from a murderer? For it has been taught, he that smote him shall surely be put to death, for he is a murderer. I only know that he may be executed with the death that is decreed for him. Whence do I know that if you cannot execute him with that death, that you may execute him with any other death? From the verse, he that smote him shall surely be put to death, implying in any manner possible. There it is different, because Scripture writes, he shall surely be put to death. Then why not derive this from it? Because the murderer and the avenging kinsman are two verses with the same object, and the teaching of such two verses does not extend to anything else.
All right, so at the end of this, it means that, you know, there are no restrictions as to how you can kill this person. Right, anyone can do it, and you can do it by any means necessary. And the analogy is through that of a rodef, which is the case of someone is trying to kill someone else, that you are in fact allowed to kill them. Mishnah in Sanhedrin 8:7, the following, here's, it's a very interesting phrase here for it. The following must be saved from sinning, even at the cost of their lives. And the first one is, he who pursues after his neighbor to slay him. Harodef et achar chaveiro laharago. Or after a male for pederasty, homosexual rape, or after a betrothed maiden to dishonor her, but he who pursues after an animal to abuse it, or would desecrate the Sabbath, or commit idolatry, must not be saved from sinning at the cost of his life. So it's an interesting collection of laws here, where the phrase is, Eloi matzilino tom benafshan. For certain cases, someone is about to sin, and instead of letting them sin, you are supposed to kill them in advance. And, well, not in advance, but you kill them to prevent them from sinning. Right? And one of them is a rodef, which is an odd way of saying, well, you know, someone's about to kill someone else. It's not like, oh, you're doing this to defend the person he's about to kill, as much as, no, you're doing it for the potential killer's own benefit. So here's the Gemara, Sanhedrin 73a. Our rabbis taught, whence do we know that he who pursues after his neighbor to slay him must be saved from sin at the cost of his own life? From the verse, thou shalt not stand by the blood of thy neighbor, lo ta'amod al dam re'echa, which you guys might remember from the class that we did on organ donation and brain death, right?
I don't think I was there for that.
Oh, well, yeah. All right, so maybe you don't. Go back and listen to it. It's a good class. But does it come to teach us? Is it not employed for the following baraita has been taught? Once we know that if a man sees his fellow drowning, mauled by beasts, or attacked by robbers, he is bound to save him. From the verse, thou shalt not stand by the blood of his neighbor. Then truth is so. Then once do we know the pursuer must be saved at the cost of his own life? It is inferred by an ad majoris, a kalva reasoning, otherwise known as a kalva chomer, from a betrothed maiden. If a betrothed maiden whom he wishes merely to dishonor, which is a weird way of phrasing it here, yet the Torah decreed that she may be saved by the life of her ravisher, how much more so does this hold good for one who pursues his neighbor to slay him? But can punishment be inflicted as a result of kal v'chomer? Ad majoris conclusion, fine. The school of Rabbi taught is described by analogy. For as when a man riseth against his neighbor and slayeth him, even so in this matter. But what do we learn from this analogy of a murderer? For the simile itself is superfluous, since the Torah explicitly states that the maiden is not punished. Hence, it implies that a certain feature of the law of the murderer holds good to here and vice versa. Thus it comes to throw light and itself is illuminated. This verse shows the case of a murderer throws light in the case of that of a betrothed maiden. The murderer is compared to a betrothed maiden, just as a betrothed maiden must be saved from dishonor at the cost of his, meaning the violator's life. So in the case of murderer, he, the victim, must be saved at the cost of his attacker's life. And whence do we know this of a betrothed maiden? It was taught by the school of Rabbi Yishmael. The school of Yishmael taught the betrothed damsel cried and there was none to save her. But if there was a rescuer, he must save her by all possible means. So this is a bit of, you know, Talmudic and biblical reasoning justifying the law of a rodev, which is someone is about to kill someone else. You are supposed to, well, you could say whether or not you're permitted to kill him versus it seems you're supposed to kill him, which seems to be the logic here. So between this and Baba Machteret, what do you think about, you know, the gun control use here? Or at least based on, you know, what you might say by contemporary applications.
Seems that, you know, if you almost are allowed to, it seems that would be somewhat okay, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, this would be the argument of, well, you know, if someone's, you know, shooting up someone, if everyone has a gun, you would stop that person, you know, who's being a rodent. If someone's, you know, out in, Columbine High School, right, if teachers had guns, you could have shot the people before they continue going. For as long as they were going and shooting around people, you could say, well, these people are, you know, are road to fame. Mm-hmm. Right? And, you know, that's one of the arguments for why more people ought to be armed, which is to prevent killing, oddly enough, because people are going to. And in those cases, you're supposed to be able to stop them. And in terms of protecting your own house, halakha is, you know, I mean, you are, there are rules in terms of when you are allowed to protect your own house with killing someone. You know, you could argue that even if you did see someone, they could still be a rodef. I mean, one of the laws about Bama Machteret is like once, you know, the sun comes up, you can no longer shoot them. But if you know the person is an armed robber and is still going to kill you, then yeah, that might not be a law. But Bama Machteret is when you don't know any better. And, you know, if the guy has a gun and you know he's a rodef, well, then sure. You know, then it doesn't mean that just because it's daylight means you're not actually out to kill somebody. Now, are these ideal? You could say no. You could also say, well, you know, just having the gun in the house, well, you know, is not an ideal situation because, you know, Baba Machteret, you know, there have been, I didn't Google this, but I'm sure you could find, like, accidental shootings in the house where someone thought you've got, like, a kid was a burglar, like, mm-hmm. coming in. Now, you could say, halachically, you might be okay, because if the person, like, came in and you don't know any better, you know, that's one thing. But you could also say that needless deaths are pointless and ought to be avoided at all costs, right? But the truth is, you could kill someone in any different way. Guns are only one medium. They happen to be a very effective and efficient way of killing people. You know, just like no one's going to have like a samurai sword on. Well, I shouldn't say no one will. Even if you're the type of person to have a samurai sword under your bed, it's probably not the easiest way to ward off, you know, attackers. Mm-hmm. Right? But, you know, self defense does seem to be, you know, an important part of halakha. And could that be accomplished with guns? Sure, it could be accomplished with other things too. But keep in mind that, you know, if you're wrong, you could very well be liable for murder. Right. And if it's a Baba Machteret situation, but, you know, the light, you know, you were able to see. And anyone a Simpsons fan?
To a degree.
All right. So there was this one episode where I think it's the Cape Fear episode. Where, you know, they were setting up all these booby traps in the house, you know, just in case they had the intruder. And Chief Wiggum, you know, told Homer, is like, you know, once someone comes into your property, you can do whatever you want. So Homer goes, hey, Flanders, come on over. It's like, no, it doesn't work if you invite him. Like, yeah. Right. And also, you know, by a rodef. You know, there's a Gemara that talks about someone saw a rodef, like, chasing after someone and came out of an alleyway with a bloody axe, and the person, you know, was dead. He's no longer a rodef at that point, you know, after you've already killed someone. So it's, you know, and when you kill someone who's, like, not in that, who's no longer a rodef, then you get into a bunch of other problems. And, you know, not, and this isn't even talking about the metaphorical, you know, people who are called rodefs, if anyone remembers the Yigal Amir stuff. Yitzchak Rabin.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was the guy who shot Yitzchak Rabin, because he was a rodef. And a lot of yeshiva are using that rhetoric, and then one person actually took it seriously. So it's a tricky issue, but it shows, you know, it's that tough line where, you know, one, because death is so significant, right? If you're right, you know, yes, you could have saved your life or perhaps saved others' lives, but if you're wrong, you're guilty of murder. That's a pretty big thing to, you know, keep in the back of your head, which is where we get to the next section here on, you know, what I call responsibility and liability, which seems to be a big part of the discussion today, too. Of, you know, let's say you just have a gun lying around. How do you treat that in terms of, you know, ways of damages, and to what extent are you responsible? Now, for this, people have tried making analogies to animals, where, you know, just like anything of property, where if I've got an ox or dogs, like I have to watch them and I'm responsible for their damage. You've got two types of categories for, let's say, oxen, which is a tam and a muad, where a tam means a very simple one, meaning, and a muad is, there's no good way to translate muad. I have here, like, suspected damage prone foreseeable risk, meaning after it gores, it's considered muad, which is, you assume, you know, an ox isn't going to mess around, like, you know, ox, they're kind of be kind of tame, but once you know that it has a personality, that becomes a muad, and then it's a separate category of a higher risk of danger, such that you need to watch over it more, and if you're negligent, there are stiffer penalties than if it's just a tam and you just pay the pure civil damages. All right? So let's start off with Mishnah Bava Kamma 2:6.
Man is always muad, automatically suspected as damage-prone, foreseeable risk, dangerous offender, whether he acts inadvertently or willfully.
Right. So everything that I mentioned was regarding animals, and I'm sort of avoiding those topics here because animals don't shoot guns. I mean, I know that's the old joke of, like, guns don't kill people, people kill people, or if you're really being snarky, bullets kill people, right? But someone has to operate the gun. Cows don't. I mean, maybe, like, if you've got an intelligent cat, you know, they would... Animals don't do it. People do it, right? So what then is the responsibility? And the main line here is Adam mu'ad la'olam. You're talking about man. Whenever you're talking about damage with man, there's no such thing as a tam, right? It's the assumption is men, and I mean men in the global sense, not in the specific gender sense. Mankind, being technical, is considered to be automatically suspected as being damage prone, such that there's a foreseeable risk and as a dangerous offender that you have to take special precautions to ensure, or at least you even if you're saying doesn't need, even if you want to say needs special precautions, you don't, even if it's just an accident, you assume that precautions were taken by man. So important to have that here, that we're dealing with guns, right? Adamuad la'olam, there's always that consideration of danger, regardless of the, you know, tool that the person is using for damage, right? Mm-hmm. It's an issue of man in terms of his own, you know, responsibility. Take the Mishnah Bava Kamma 6:4.
Okay. If a man sent out something burning through a deaf mute, an idiot, or a minor, and damage resulted, he would be exempt from the judgments of man, but liable in accordance with judgments of heaven. But if he sent it through a normal person, the normal person would be liable.
So this, to me, seemed to be the closest analogy to the gun case. Why? So this is a case, again, if, let's say, I give... So a deaf mute, an idiot, and a minor, cheresh, shota, and katan, are three categories of individuals who, halachically, are not considered as having da'at, as having knowledge of intention. In American law, you know, there are different rules if you're a minor versus, you know, you're tried as an adult because your brain is informed well and can't make the right decisions. And we don't hold you as accountable for those actions. So let's say I gave one of these people a torch, like one of the Olympic torch things. And I hand it to them. And that's it. Like, you could say, it doesn't say here necessarily gave them any instructions, but, like, let's say I gave them a burning flame and they go off and they burn down a building. It says here, right, it's chayav bedine shemayim, I'm obligated somehow in the hands of heaven, but I'm exempt from the hands of man, meaning it seems that whatever liability I incur is divine, but I can't incur any civil penalties. But if it was through a normal person, then the normal person would be obligated. So if there's someone and I gave it to them and he does something with it, I'm not liable, that person is. So what does this tell you?
That if you... I don't know. What does that mean?
Well, what do you think? So normally you could say, like, by today's standards, you could say, well, if I gave, you know, an idiot a blowtorch or, you know, a thing of fire, that I was negligent.
Right.
Halacha doesn't recognize that, though.
No.
Because the sentience of man means each person is an individual, adam u'ad la'atzmo. The fact that they may not have their own sense of knowledge, yes, they may not be held liable, but because I did not directly do it, you can't, like, there are things about a gerama, about when you cause a certain degree of danger. But once there's another human being involved, that causal link is broken. Right? Continue with the Gemara above a comma 59b.
Resh Lakish said, in the name of Chazkiya, the Mishnaic ruling holds good only where he handed over a flickering coal to the deaf mute, who fanned it into a flame. But if he handed over to him something already in flame, he would be liable. The reason being that it was his acts that were the immediate cause.
Right, so one opinion is, well, no, that there has to be some transformative act of that person that you gave the thing to, so that you could say it's not really me. But if it's that well known that if I do this, you know, give this to this person, it is so assured that he's going to damage, then it's my fault. However,
right. Rabbi Yochanan, however, said, even where he handed something already inflamed to him, he would still be exempt. The reason being that it was the handling of the deaf mute that caused the damage. He could therefore not be liable unless where he handed over to him tinder, shavings and a light. In which case, it was certainly his act that was the immediate cause.
Right. So the question that is, what is really, you know, the immediate cause here? To what extent are you actually doing that? If I give this to someone, I know with 100% certainty that this is going to happen. Inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because these people don't have da'at on their own. Mm-hmm. Right? Mishnah Bava Kama 8:4 says, a deaf mute and idiot minor are awkward to deal with. I really hate that translation, that Cincinnati's. Right, as he who injures them is liable to pay, whereas if they injure others, they are exempt. Right, so this would be a matter of, you know, if one of them, you know, actually picks up a, you know, gun, you know, and well, we'll do one more here. Mishnah above a comma 4:4, if an ox of an owner with unimpaired faculties gores an ox of a deaf mute or an idiot or a minor, the owner is liable. Where, however, the ox of a deaf-mute idiot or minor gored an ox of an owner whose faculties are unimpaired, there is no liability. If an ox of a deaf-mute idiot or minor has gored, the court of law appoints a guardian in whose presence witnesses will testify that the ox gored so that it will eventually be declared muad and then come under a different category. So you're talking, let's say, you know, we'll stop here for a moment. You know, when you try to make the analogy today to, you know, if you have a gun lying around and you've got cases of, you know, we don't need to discuss how, you know, murder is bad and murder is prohibited. But there are a lot of discussions here about how do you keep guns out of the hands of people and who's really responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, according to this, and there are halachot in terms of who's really considered a shoteh in that category of idiot, although it's a, you know, wide-ranging definition there. But in order for you as an individual to really be held liable for it, you would have to actually, like, hand the person the gun. Let's say it's in my house under, you know, let's moderate or even, you know, little security. If the person goes and picks it up on his own, I'm not really going to be liable for that because there's no direct cause. Even in the case from Bava Kama 59b, that's when you physically hand them something. Right, so then maybe you can say, oh, it was your, you know, handing the person the action that caused something to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly you can say, well, maybe if you handed it, but even with a gun, just because you hand, you know, someone a gun, it doesn't mean they're going to shoot up an elementary school, right?
What mm-hmm. about the idea of a stumbling block?
That's an interesting point. So that would be for an ESER, for a prohibition, but giving someone a gun isn't necessarily a stumbling block. I give you an AK-47...
Right.
That there's no correlation between you holding an AK-47 and shooting up a kindergarten.
But we're talking about someone whose faculties are impaired.
Yeah,
whatever
but
that means.
There are dozens of things you can do with a machine gun. You know, you can put it down in like a whole number of places, right? You know, now maybe if it's, you know, if it's under a certain scenario where it's inevitable, I say, here, go shoot this. You know, maybe there would be some liability, but even then, you know, it wouldn't be, you know, the same as a murder.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the individual who does it though is also not considered is considered exempt. But the focus here, is not, it is, I would say, independent of the tool used. Like, to me, the fire seems to be, you know, the I think a more apt analogy than the damage done by an animal. Because in the fire analogy, fire is a tool, right? You could use it for a lot of different things. Here it was used to damage. And also the perpetrator is a person. And there are times when the person themselves aren't going to be considered halakhically accountable for their actions. And it doesn't matter what or how. So, you know, arguments about gun control are going to be irrelevant from this case. I mean, you can say, you know, given that Necheres Shoten Katan might be more susceptible to doing damage, you don't want to expose them to any form of, you know, items that would be easy to cause damage. But, you know, if they pick it up and go ahead and do it, from a liability standpoint, the responsibility and liability seem primarily to be on the individual who conducts certain things. Now, maybe you don't punish them for it, right? And sometimes you can have damage done and no one, you know, pays for it. Right, which is what the thing is, the Necheres Shoten Katan. Mm-hmm. Like, if a katan goes and, you know, damages like a whole slew of windows, you know, stinks to be the owners because, you know, where are you going to collect it from? You don't go to the father for that, right? You go, you can't collect from the kid, mm-hmm. right? So there's a distinction here between the tool and the individual. And my understanding is that from the halachic system, the focus is less on the tool as much as the person. Adamu ad la'olam. A person is always considered to be at risk and therefore responsible for his own actions and for his own behaviors, regardless of what the tool is. So it's not really guns that are the problem, it's people that are the problem. There's one exception. It's the Gemara in Avodah Zarah 15b. It has further been taught, one should not sell them either weapons or accessories, nor should one grind weapon for them, nor may one sell them either stocks or necklaces, neck chains or ropes or iron chains, neither to idolaters nor to Kuthians. Now, what is the reason? Shall we say that they, the Kuthians, are suspected of murder? But they are suspect, seeing as we have just said one may... But are they suspect, seeing as we have just said one may be alone with them? Hence, it is only because he might sell it to an idolater. Should you, moreover, say that a Kuthian will not repent, an Israelite will repent? Shiller of Nachman said in Rav Barabua, just as it is said that it is forbidden to sell to an idolater, so too it is forbidden to sell to an Israelite who is suspected of selling it to an idolater. Here, Rabbah thereupon ran 3 parsings, Persian miles, after the buyer of his donkey to an Israelite who is suspected of selling to idolaters. Some say a parsing was along the same line, but failed to overtake him. If Dibi Barba said, just as it is forbidden to sell to an idolater, so it is forbidden to sell to a robber who is an Israelite. What are the circumstances? If he is suspected of murder, it is quite plain he is the same as an idolater. If, on the other hand, he has never committed murder, why not sell it to him? It refers to indeed one who has not committed murder, but we may be dealing with a cowardly thief who is apt at times when caught to save himself by committing murder. Right, so here, so a couple of instances here is, right, we mentioned before about, you know, liabilities in terms of, you know, what you would do with, like, items of damage in individuals who would then go off and do damage on their own. This is an interesting set of halachot here in terms of perspectives on guns, which is selling weapons, which is kind of interesting because a major donor to 2 major yeshivot, in fact, made the family money from selling a lot of weapons. And the super, super irony of this is at my Chag HaSmicha, which is every 4 years YU has an anniversary of, not anniversary, I was saying, every 4 years they have a ceremony for people who get ordained instead of a formal graduation. Mm-hmm. And this individual who gained a great deal of money through running guns got the Eitz Chaim Award. The Tree of Life Award. And someone else, one of the other people on faculty, who is one of the most gentle people, got an Aluf HaTorah Award, which means the chieftain of Torah. Like, the kids of Esav got the title Aluf. I was like, you couldn't reverse the awards. It would have been so... Yeah, that's what I was thinking of during my Chag HaSmicha. Anyway, the concern is here, you don't sell weapons to idolaters. Why? Because they're going to use them against Jews to kill them. Mm-hmm. You don't sell them to Kutim either, because even if they won't use it to murder Jews, they'll sell it to idolaters, who'll then go and murder Jews. And Rav Dimi Barber says, you don't even sell it to a Jewish person who's like not even a murderer, even if he's not a murderer yet, if he's a cowardly thief, because he might come to commit murder. Interesting. So here, you're talking about a restriction against the sale. Now, if you did it, you wouldn't necessarily be held liable for it, right?
Right.
Because you didn't commit murder. But that also seems to be not the point. It's when you know that, or with a great deal of assurances, these weapons are going to be used, and are going to be used inappropriately, you have a rabbinic prohibition against selling them. So there's a prohibition even though there's no liability. Right, so when you're talking about, say, gun control, this would have less to do with owning guns as much as, you know, distributing guns. And I can say, well, if there's someone I know who is, let's say a sociopath, right? Now, I would not be allowed to, psychopath, I get those two mixed up. Someone whom I know has a very real chance of committing murder, then I would not be allowed to give that person guns or any other assorted weapons. Mm-hmm. Or even if I would just have a reasonable suspicion that this person would. But that's a burden on me, right? Because if I run a weapon shop, someone comes in and is like, one example, like one of the regulations we have in America are background checks, mm-hmm. right? Ostensibly for that very reason, to make sure that this is a person who, say, doesn't have a criminal record. Mm-hmm. Or at least, because if you say, hey, this person's got a rap sheet, includes armed robbery, probably be a bad idea mm-hmm. to give him a firearm, right? So that would seem to be part of the halach here. When you've got that real risk, you do not help facilitate. Are you liable for it? No. But there is an issur against it, because you also don't want to be stupid. And even if there's a middleman here, right? Because you could say, oh, I didn't sell to the non-Jew directly. And yes, if they're non-Jews listening at the time, there was, in fact, a real risk of non-Jews killing Jews. But I don't sell it to them directly, so instead I sell it to someone else who's going to sell it to someone else, that middleman. Anyone see, Lords of War?
You have Lord of War?
Lord of War, something like that. It was a Nick Cage movie.
Yeah, we have.
We own it. We've never watched it.
It was left to Jamie in her room.
it's a good movie to see now. So,
you can see it. Yeah.
Yeah, spoiler alert. The guy's like a middleman in terms uh-huh. of the arms dealer. So it would be like selling to him, knowing that he's going to sell it to other people, mm-hmm. would still be a problem. Like, you're thinking even one step down the road, which is odd, because you normally think, well, just... like, once you have a transaction, I don't really care where it goes. I'm like, actually, no, you do. For things like weapons, again, you're talking about potentially killing people, right? In this case, specifically Jews. And you don't want that to happen, so you have to be very careful with where your weapons go. Mm-hmm. So, what does this mean for, again, American policy? Absolutely nothing, because we've got constitutional law. But in terms of, for... all the people that I saw at the protests about, like, Jewish law mandates stricter gun control laws, the answer, in my opinion, is false. Because the problem isn't the guns so much as the people, mm-hmm. right? Because even with this Gemara in Avodah Zarah, the problem isn't the weapons, the problem is you taking the action to sell the weapons, right? Now, you could argue that, well, yes, by regulating guns, we are minimizing the potential for damage. That is a true statement. But is that really the halachic approach? To my mind, no. To my mind, it seemed... you could. You mentioned about Lifnei Iver, mm-hmm. right? So if you don't have guns, you don't have to do it. But the guns themselves are not intrinsically evil. They could be used for evil purposes, and they could also be used for very necessary purposes, such as defense. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that arming, having an armed guard by every school is a good idea? I have no idea. Mm-hmm. Probably not. That's my guess. Whatever. Anyway, so the major, point to get across here is like, yes, you can, if you have a particular affinity towards one gun policy or another gun policy in American law, fine. But don't start bringing Jewish law into mm-hmm. it, because Jewish law, especially regarding damages, is a lot more nuanced and a lot more complicated. And the burden is placed more on the individual. Now, one thing that did come that not as many people are talking about is, policies for dealing with the mentally ill, which would seem to make a lot more sense, especially given, we've had two subway pushings recently in New York. Yes, I'm sorry for scaring people. But
yeah, sure.
So that could be that would be, I would say, a more humane question than just dealing with, you know, restricting the gun, or at least from a halachic perspective, right? Based on what, you know, mentioned here. From a policy perspective, I will let other people deal with. Right? Thank you for coming out. Have a wonderful night.